Welcome to All Things Marine, Hawaii's thought-provoking show dedicated to marine science and ocean conservation. All Things Marine, brought to you by Kosi Island Earth and the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And now, here's your host, the marine science gal, Carly Weiner.
Aloha. I'm Holly Lauritsen, filling in for your marine science gal, Carly Weiner. Today we are going to hear from three outstanding researchers as they discuss their fascinating research on the marine microbiome. While the microbes in the ocean might be small, as we'll hear, they play a big role in maintaining the ocean's health. While the University of Hawaii has been a leader in microbiome research for quite some time, in the past 2 years, the programs for the marine microbiome in particular have entered the national stage. Our three guests today will give us a guide into what the microbiome is, how we can study it, and the impact that microbes are having on other life in the ocean. Joining us first is Dr. Oscar Sosa, a researcher at the University of Hawaii. Oscar, can you start us off with an overview of the marine microbiome?
Hi, Holly. Thank you for having me on the show. I'm very excited. Of course, marine scientists refer to the marine microbiome as the community of microscopic organisms that inhabit the ocean. I like to think of it as an invisible forest because in the microbiome, we have microbes that photosynthesize and are the base of the food web. We also have bacteria that decompose and recycle non-living matter, which is a very important process. And as you'll hear from our other guests, there's microbes that live in close proximity with other organisms in the ocean, like corals and fish and other animals. All of these are a very important part of the microbiome.
Great, thank you. So it sounds like it's more than just bacteria. Are there viruses or other components that are important to the microbiome?
Yes, absolutely. The microbiome is very, very diverse. Viruses, for example, exist that can infect bacteria and other organisms like microalgae and are very important to keep in place the abundances and populations of these organisms. There's also bacteria that live in proximity in the guts of fish and other animals.
Great. So why should we be interested in the marine microbiome? Does the microbiome impact our day-to-day lives?
Yes, there are many ways in which microbes in the ocean impact our day-to-day lives. And they do so by providing ecosystem services that we often take for granted. For example, at the University of Hawaii, I study bacteria that decompose and recycle non-living organic matter. What that is a process by which the food web can keep cycling and functioning. There's also a lot of natural products and materials that we obtain from marine microbes. For example, microalgae called diatoms, when they grow, they sink to the bottom of the ocean when they're dying and produce a type of sedimentary rock called diatomaceous earth. In industry, we use this material, for example, in ingredients in toothpaste, something that a lot of us use. And one example that I love to talk about is the photosynthetic microorganisms in the ocean produce half of the oxygen in the planet. So every other breath you take, you owe it to a microbe in the ocean.
Great. It sounds like we all have a lot to be thankful for with respect to the microbiome then. So how did you become interested in the microbiome and decide to focus on that for your research?
About 6 years ago, when I finished college, I decided I want to apply for a graduate school program and I wanted to study microbiology. And so I came across a lot of researchers that were studying marine microbes, and they were doing it because the ocean is so vast and those microbes were having a big impact on the planet's climate and on the environment. So that got me hooked, their prevalence in the environment.
Great. So then in your current research, you're looking at those interactions between microbes in the ocean and their environment, particularly sugars that exist in the water. What led you to that particular aspect of marine science? Where do those sugars come from? And can you just give us a little bit more background on that research?
For sure. When I started graduate school, I was interested in studying bacteria that participated in the decomposition of non-living matter. And so sugars, also known as carbohydrates, are part of that non-living matter. And it turns out that as some of these bacteria decompose the sugars, they release methane into the water and into the atmosphere. This is a very important greenhouse gas, as you've probably heard of.
Great. Do you know what portion of the methane produced in the world is coming from these microbes?
We're beginning to understand how the process works and what controls the methane production in the surface water. So we still don't know how much it is. The oceans by themselves are estimated to produce about 10% of the natural methane emissions in the planet. But this is a very small amount compared to other sources like wetlands and compared to anthropogenic sources of methane.
Okay. So then are these microbial populations found throughout the ocean or are they targeted to specific areas?
The basic thing we know right now is that more than likely the oceans, the bacteria that produce these sugars and that break them down into methane are found all over the world. But we have clues that tell us that some of these bacteria, for example, might be more abundant in specific parts of the ocean. So that's the next big question in our field.
Do you have an idea right now what parts of the ocean might host these over others?
Yes, there's a very interesting process that occurs in the ocean that has to do with how many nutrients there are for bacteria to grow. And in areas of the ocean where there's very little phosphorus, for example, we think stimulates the abundance of these microbes that produce methane. So these are regions in many places of the ocean, but one of the main ones we think is the North Atlantic Ocean.
So are the same bacteria producing the sugars and breaking them down, or are there separate populations of microbes that are contributing to these greenhouse gases?
Holly, that's a great question. I actually think you would be a great marine microbiologist. And the short answer to that is we don't know yet. But it seems right now that there's bacteria that produce them and bacteria that break them down.
Great. So then how are you going about studying this? What technologies are you using and how are they different from other strategies?
Okay, well, one of the things I do in the lab is called genetics. And I do that because it's important for this work to test directly what genes in the microbes are necessary to degrade these sugars and therefore produce methane. There are other strategies like genomics and metagenomics that essentially allow you to have a long list of all the genes in a microbe or in the environment. However, by itself, genomics cannot prove what those genes are for. That's why in the lab I combine genomics and genetics. They're complementary.
Great. Are there any new genetic tools on the horizon that you think could help facilitate your research or build on genomics and genetics?
Yes. Well, more and more, there are advances in technologies that allow us to study genes and microbes in the ocean. One of those are what we call next-generation sequencing techniques. And the better and better these technologies become, more and more scientists all over the world can employ techniques like metagenomics to study the marine microbiome. And that is something I look forward to. So as a researcher, I can apply more and more.
Great. Could you go into a little bit more detail about how you go about even collecting the bacteria and bringing them into the lab and analyzing them?
Of course. When we want to study bacteria, the marine microbiome, we normally, in Hawaii, go out to sea on a large ship dedicated for research. Then, once we're at sea, away from the Hawaiian Islands or away from the mainland, we collect bacteria and other other biota, other life forms in the ocean on filters. So we do a lot of what I like to call microbial plumbing, because we rely a lot on pumps, filters, to collect our samples. It's actually really fun once you learn how to do it.
Nice. And where has that research brought you? Have you been able to travel around the Hawaiian Islands?
We mainly go out about 100 kilometers north of the Hawaiian Islands in a place called Station Aloha. So this is a geographic circle where we go and study what we call the open ocean environment.
What is the open ocean environment compared to other environments?
Well, out here in the Pacific Ocean, the open ocean is characterized by being very poor in nutrients, having low biomass, very few organisms concentrated in the water compared to a coastal environment where there's a lot more nutrients coming in through rivers and through human activities. So they're very different in that sense.
Thanks. So if you know that there are populations of greenhouse gas producing microbes, do you know if those are changing or if there are ways to reduce the number of greenhouse gas producing microbes?
That's another very interesting question. Right now, we don't have enough information to know if the populations of microbes that produce methane are changing. Most likely they are, because the more industrialized our cities become, the more the ocean feels the human impact, and therefore the microscopic life in the ocean. One thing we do know is that these microbes that produce methane are essential for the food web and for the health of the ocean. So we wouldn't want to change how these microbes are working in the environment. We want to try to address the emission of methane in industry and in our habits as people.
I think we all need to keep the environment in mind as we go through our day-to-day lives. So in your other answers, you mentioned that the North Atlantic seems to be an area where these microbes might be very numerous. Do you have plans to go out and test that, or what's next for your research?
That's exactly where I'm heading next. I will be traveling to the East Coast in May of this year to join my colleagues on a research expedition into the North Atlantic. We'll be sailing out of Woods Hole, going all the way to the Bermuda Islands, and we're going to study bacteria and other organisms that produce methane.
Perfect. Do you have any expectations for what you might find, or what might be next after that?
Well, the expectation is that the bacteria that produce methane are more abundant there. We don't know still, however, what are the most important controls on the production of methane. And where next? Well, for example, there are other regions of the ocean, like the Mediterranean Sea, that also might have a large number of these bacteria because of the way the environment is structured there. That has a lot to do with how many nutrients there are in the water.
Okay. So this is a very fascinating topic for a lot of our listeners. And do you know, are there other resources that they could turn to if they're interested in learning more about genomics or genetic approaches?
Yes, there's a lot of information online, actually. There's also books. One of them I can think of is called The New Science of Metagenomics. This is a book published in 2007 by the National Research Council, and it's written in a way that's very accessible to scientists and non-scientists, so I recommend that book to begin. There's also a lot of online resources. For example, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, has on their website a lot of links with information about the importance of marine microbes in the ocean. Then at our university, the Center for Microbial Oceanography Research and Education, CMOR, has on their homepage a link about education and outreach. And in this link, there's a lot of materials and resources to teach K through 12 students and the general public about the diversity and the importance of marine microbes. Have one last plug. If you're in San Francisco, make sure to visit the Exploratorium Museum. It's on Pier 15. They have a gallery on living systems. Make sure to find the exhibit on plankton populations. It's an interactive map created in collaboration with MIT scientists. And the map allows you to see all of the marine microbiome populations that are most important in different parts of the ocean. It's really cool. It's hands-on experience for kids.
Perfect. That sounds like it would be fun even if you're not a kid.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much. Do you have any other last words of interest about the marine microbiome or what you're looking forward to in the future?
Well, I'm looking for a job. I would love to be a professor at a university teaching students about the marine microbiome. It's very important.
All right. All faculty hiring committees, keep Oscar Sosa in mind. Well, thank you so much. We'll take a quick break before hearing more about the marine microbiome from our next guest, Dr. Ruth Gates.
Quarterback looking, firing across the middle. Wow, what a grab in traffic. Larson really had defenders hanging all over, but somehow he comes up with the football.
On the football field, you've got to stay focused and not get distracted.
NFL Hall of Famer and President and CEO of CTIA, the Wireless Association, Steve Largent.
The same is true on the road. So before your wireless phone becomes a distraction, take a time out for safety. Place your phone in easy reach before you leave. Never take notes or look up a phone number while you're driving. In bad weather or traffic, call later. Dial sensibly and use a hands-free device. You know, your wireless phone can be your best safety tool. To call for help, stop a crime, or help someone in need. However you use it, remember, with wireless, safety is your call.
The wireless industry reminds you to drive safely. For more information, visit www.wirelesssafety.org.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Holly Lauritsen, filling in for your marine science gal, Carly Weiner. Today we are talking about the fascinating microbial life in the ocean and the impact of the microscopic communities on ocean health. Up next is Dr. Ruth Gates, a professor at the University of Hawaii and the leader of the Gates Coral Lab. Welcome, Dr. Gates.
Thank you very much, Holly. It's a pleasure to be here.
Many of our listeners may recognize you from your contributions to our understanding of coral reefs. How does the microbiome play a role in coral reef health?
You know, the microbiome is critical to the health of all organisms and to the entire planet. So when we think about humans or we think about a coral, we think about the cells that make up that particular organism. But actually, we, a coral, the planet, we're just a home for millions of microorganisms, and all of those microorganisms play a role in either maintaining the health of the thing that they inhabit or diminishing the health of that thing. Now, for corals, they're experts, really, at using the biology of other organisms. And so they are inhabited by millions of bacteria, viruses, microalgae, and these microorganisms collectively function and coordinate the health of their animal host. And it's that whole set of organisms that, when disrupted, cause corals to die.
That's fascinating. So do each different type of coral have a different type of microbiome, or are they influenced by the water around them, or how do they establish this complex microbial life?
That is a great question, and one we're just starting to get a handle on. But I'll say this, you know, when we talk about humans, we're one species, and we still don't fully understand the microbiome of humans. When we talk about corals, we're talking about hundreds of different species, ancient organisms that have been on the planet for over 200 million years. And we've only sampled a few of those species in detail. And when we've sampled individuals from a given species of coral, we've tended to only do it from one or two locations. And so the current thinking is that the microbiomes of individual coral species are extremely tuned to the animal itself and reflecting nuances in the environment in which they live. So let's talk about the complexity of the structure of corals. Corals can be looking like boulders, they can look like trees, they can creep across the surface. Well, if you could imagine you're a microorganism inhabiting a tiny space, the spaces created by all those different growth forms are quite different. And we think that the microbiome, or who lives where they live, is more reflective of the environment that is created, the structure of a place, than it is by necessarily the species. And so to give you a sort of an example of that, if you sample the same coral species over a variety of different depths on the reef, you will find the microbiome to be extraordinarily different between a shallow water coral and a deep water coral. But if you sample that same coral multiple times at the same depth, you will find that those microbiomes are much more similar to one another.
Sounds like you definitely have your work cut out for you then in understanding the microbiome. So then what sparked your interest in focusing on the microbial life in the coral reefs?
Well, you know, corals, you cannot speak about corals without talking about microorganisms. So the most famous microbe in the coral system is this microalgae that is found deep inside the tissues of corals. In fact, these microalgae are so intimately interwoven with the biology of corals that they are the very food source for the animal itself. So like all plants, and as Oscar's alluded to, these plants can do the thing that is required to create food, that is harness sunlight to combine water and carbon dioxide into a small sugar molecule that then can be used to feed the animal. And that sugar is, of course, the base of the food chain. Corals have these things deep inside their tissues. These microalgae are like food factories. They're pounding out food. The coral eats it. And it is that food that keeps the coral healthy enough to grow and reproduce. So I've been studying corals for 29 years, it seems to be now, as I counted quite recently. And it turns out that I was fascinated by this extraordinary coordination of biology between a tiny plant and an animal. We can't do it. Humans don't have plants living inside them that gives them food. And the question is why? Why are corals so expert and so competent at maintaining a population of microalgae in their tissues? And, you know, over the years that I've been studying it, we've realized that it's not just having microalgae that's important, but it's who that microalgae is. So some of them feed their animal, their coral host, better than others. Sometimes when the relationship is stressed by an environmental condition, like warming associated with climate change, we find the relationship breaks down and another algae will get in that doesn't feed its animal quite as well. It's an opportunist. It's sneaky. It just comes in when the animal isn't feeling so great. And that's when you can see a healthy microbiome suddenly becoming detrimental to the animal host. And we now know that for corals, this is a pivotal shift. And in humans, we know that our microbiome, our gut microbiome, is critically important to maintaining our human health.
So it sounds like the microbial life in the coral reefs could be a new indicator for overall coral reef health and potentially indicate changes that would have been more subtle in the past, that the corals are starting to die or being negatively affected by the environmental changes.
Absolutely, and potentially early indicators. So, you know, when we really think about how we look at stress on reefs, what we tend to look for is a coral has died to tell us that there's a problem, right? So we do this thing like measure the percent of cover on a coral reef as an indicator of the overall health of that system. So when that declines, it means loads of corals have died. So imagine if we had an early indicator of a problem. Now, what's new about the microbiome work is that we've added to our understanding of the microalgae and these small plants, which we've really been studying for, you know, really a long, long time now. We've now added this emerging understanding of the bacteria and the viruses, the tools that we have at our disposal today, the technology to do science is extraordinary and has enabled us to unveil this extraordinary biodiversity in these tiny organisms that we couldn't before visualize. And so now we're starting to look at that for as with respect to coral health. And we're really interested in these sort of these decision points in those communities. What happens when things go wrong? What are the early indicators? Who changes first in this population or community or massive group of algae, bacteria and viruses that are inside these individual corals? Are there indicator species that tell us very early that things are going awry?
Have you been able to identify any of those individual species yet as indicators?
You know, the way that we do it is actually to leverage the previous sort of iteration of microbiology. There's, you know, when people talk about bacteria, really they almost always think about things that are bad, right? I got a bacteria and I got an infection. Right. So actually, we know a lot about this group we call pathogenic bacteria. Right. So we know much more about those than the healthy microbiome, which is the new discussion. Right. The new synthesis is microbes are good for you, not microbes are bad for you. So what we're looking for is that the things that have been basically linked to diseases in corals, we're looking for their emergence in the healthy microbiome, how quickly we can detect signals that the immune system of that coral is diminished, that, you know, these opportunistic things that are floating around in the seawater, and this alludes to one of your earlier questions, is the microbiome of coral different from the microbes in the seawater? The answer is sometimes. When a coral is really happy, the answer is yes, because it is maintaining its boundary. It's keeping out anything that's pathogenic outside in the water. When a coral gets unhealthy, just like we do, it loses its ability to fight off the things that want to invade it. You know, if you really think about biology, it's all about maintaining your space and fighting off the invaders who want a piece of you. So when a coral is unhealthy, its immune system is compromised. Now we start to see these opportunist pathogens coming in and disease states start to appear. And indeed, this is what happened in the Caribbean when the reefs in the Caribbean started to decline, massive pollution events, massive overfishing. We started to see huge amounts of coral disease and were able to isolate bacteria and groups of bacteria that are associated with each of those. So we look for those in our healthy corals, and hopefully we don't find any, but invariably we do, lurking in the background, just really waiting for conditions to be perfect, for them to reproduce quickly and take over a particular space on a coral.
Yeah. For those opportunistic microbes that are in the water, are those something that we have control over? Are they from humans? Are they from other animals? Or are they just naturally occurring in the water and waiting for their chance to strike?
There is no doubt that for corals, the interaction with humans is quite intimate. So we find corals, for the most part, quite close to shore. And so what we do on land influences the quality of the water that the corals see and use. And what we're starting to see emerge is that where we have a lot of people and we start to have problems with sewage treatment, for example, we have large rainwater runoff that really reflects the fact that we've poured concrete everywhere to make our lives easier. What we're seeing now is bacteria that are either human or land associated starting to appear in corals. And of course, their immune systems are not equipped really to deal with these kinds of pathogens, right? It's just not what they're used to. So, you know, human fecal bacteria, that is really bacteria from human poo, has been found in corals and is causing problems with coral health. So anything that we can do on land to maintain high quality in the sea water that we swim in will have a huge benefit for the corals. What is good for corals is good for us. We should never forget that if you're swimming in water that you don't think is good for you, it's definitely not going to be good for corals. And let's remember, coral reefs support us in our livelihoods here in Hawaii, being critical for coastal security, place for food that we eat, and of course, a platform for tourism that is our economic driver in this state.
Yeah, those are some great reminders to help protect the water and all the life in it. Going back to one of your earlier thoughts about how some of the microbes are actually beneficial, Are you using any of these beneficial microbes to help restore coral reefs, or is that another way to supplement the already ongoing processes to protect the coral reefs that still exist?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the reality is that humans have pushed coral reefs to a point where they are no longer healthy. I am the president of the International Society for Reef Studies, and our organization put out a statement saying that all reefs will be massively degraded by 2050 unless we do something. 2050. So, in my mind, that has now stimulated us to be very active about how we solve the problem. And there's a whole heap of solutions that are in the area of really mitigating the problems of warming, which are driving the majority of the degradation on reefs. And that is the mitigation of fossil fuel burning. My group specifically and a number of other groups have moved into, well, I'm a biologist, what do I do with my biological knowledge? And what we're doing with the microbes is we understand that many of the microbes that are on and in corals can be captured in the mucus. And the question is, these corals are throwing off this sort of sticky stuff constantly. If you've ever rubbed your hand over a coral, which I hope you haven't, you'll find you come away feeling a bit slimy. Well, that's the mucus the coral is basically giving off. The microbes are in that layer. And so what we're asking is, if we have a coral that is healthy sitting next door to a coral that is looking very unwell, could we drip the mucus from one coral onto the next one? And this is really analogous to what we're doing with humans, with human fecal transplants, where we're essentially taking the fecal bacteria from a healthy human being and implanting it into a very, very sick human being. And so those experiments are in progress right now, both in my own lab and in labs in Australia. It is an area that is particularly interesting because it's not very interventional, right? You're not killing anything to get to that outcome. And of course, anything that helps us save reefs is worth a try, in my opinion, at this point.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen any promising results with that yet?
We have not. And so when I say this is ongoing work right now, it is ongoing. We don't even know how to do those experiments. Do you have to take the coral out of the water for a period of time? How do you drip mucus? How do you collect mucus? Do you take mucus from every part of the coral or just from a... this is what science is about. Science is the most exciting thing to do because you get to play. You get to develop scientific protocols based on tinkering. I'm going to try something and see if it works. And then I'm going to use my best evidence to answer the question, does it or does it not? And if the answer is no, you have to walk on and do something different. If the answer is yes, then you develop it further. Science is extraordinary in letting you really be creative with your approach. So that's where we are, with this very creative first steps down this very long road.
Is there one thing that you think is, you know, that essential key that will unlock the answer to helping protect coral reefs? Or if you could know one thing about the way the coral marine microbiome works, what would you want to know?
You know, the really important thing is to understand who's there, where they are, for how long, and what they're doing, right? We have such a rudimentary understanding of how microbes partner with corals that it's very hard to answer the question, is there an early indicator of a health dysfunction that is going to be useful for all coral species? We just don't have enough information. We are in the discovery phase. It's like going to space, going onto a reef, because there is so much yet to be discovered. We need this fundamental basic research to then platform these strategies to protect the system. And without this basic research, we're lost. There's no quick answer. There's no simple solution to saving a group of organisms that have been on the planet for such a long time and that are so complex themselves. You know, hundreds of species in one group, amazingly beautiful things that are really the trees and the forests. They're the things that create the structure where all other organisms live. Amazing.
It definitely is amazing, and thank you for providing that insight. Is there anything that you would like to share with our listeners if they're interested in either learning more about corals or helping to protect the corals that still exist?
Absolutely. I mean, all I can say is that every person in this state is intimately linked to the coral reefs and has a responsibility to take care of them. And so anything that you see that you think is a problem on the reef, act to change. Do one thing differently in your life to change the trajectory of climate change, right? Anything, do one thing to really help change the prognosis for coral reefs. If we don't all do it together, I fear that we will lose Hawaii's coral reefs and coral reefs throughout the world.
We cannot echo that sentiment enough. If you guys still haven't made a New Year's resolution, that's a good one. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We'll take a quick break before coming back to learn more about the marine microbiome.
You mean I could have diabetes and not even know it?
Then why would I want to know?
Heart disease, amputations, stroke, blindness can all be caused by diabetes. So it's critical that you know. If you're over 45, you don't exercise, and you're overweight, you're at risk. But a simple blood test can detect the problem, and with early treatment, you can prevent the devastating effects of diabetes. Call the American Diabetes Association at 1-800-DIABETES. Don't be blind to diabetes.
Mom?
Dad?
How long should I wait for you?
Mom?
If I'm at soccer practice,
what if something happens? Will you come get me?
There's no reason not to have a plan in case of a terrorist attack.
Mom, if you're not home,
should we go to the neighbor's house?
And some extremely good reasons why you should.
Can you tell me?
Everybody should have a plan. Take 5 minutes to talk about where you'll meet and how you'll get in touch with each other in an emergency. For other things you can do to be prepared, visit www.ready.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to All Things Marine. If you're just joining us, I'm Holly Lauritsen, filling in today for Carly Weiner, the Marine Science Gal. We are continuing our discussion of the marine microbiome and the impacts of the microbial life in the health of the oceans and its inhabitants. Joining us now is Dr. Tara Essick-Burns. Welcome, Tara.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Tara, your interests around how microbes impact marine animals. Could you describe your interests and why you were engaged in that topic?
Yes, I'm very interested in interactions between microbes and marine animals. Bacteria have been around, well, they were around for about 2 billion years before the first eukaryotes, with the first marine invertebrates originating a while after that. So one thing we've all alluded to today is that the ocean is chock full of microorganisms. So that fact, combined with the fact that all marine animals evolved in this rich microbial environment, means that they had to find a way to cope with microbes, constantly trying to stick to them, to form biofilms, and circulating through them. So what I find really interesting is the diversity of relationships that exist between these two very different types of organisms, microorganisms and macroorganisms like plants or animals in the marine world. So there may be certain types of microorganisms that a marine plant or animal can't tolerate to stick to them at all. Perhaps it secretes a toxin that harms them. And so the animal needs to detect that and clear it off of them in some way. In addition to the type of microorganism that could matter in this interaction, the part of the animal can matter too. For example, on the hard surface of a crab, the animal can easily clear this biofilm off. They can pick it off with their claws, they can bury, they can, and they molt frequently. But on other parts, like sensory areas, on their dactyls or legs, or on the eggs that they carry on the underside, it's vital to keep these areas clean and free of bacteria. And of course, many marine organisms have developed intimate relationships with microorganisms and require them to interact for something important to happen in the animal or the plant's development or life history. So it's this range of the nature of these interactions and the dynamics of the relationships that I find very intriguing.
Nice. Is there one animal in particular that caught your attention?
Well, yeah, I started my graduate work studying barnacles, and I also studied two types of crabs. But barnacles are interesting because they experience very different lifestyles at different stages of development. So as larvae, they go through several swimming stages, common to many invertebrates, until they reach this unique stage where they have these two appendages, where they can walk along a surface, and they're basically scouting for a good place to settle and live there for the rest of their life. So this is this really unique stage, and then once they find a good spot, taking into account all sorts of sensory information, then they undergo this huge developmental transition where they go from this mobile larvae to a sessile juvenile with a completely different body plan and shape and everything. So they have to choose a good place to stop because they're going to be there for the rest of their life and they can't move again. So this is what happens to all marine invertebrates that stick to things. This is called biofouling. And so they stick to any hard surface like rocks or pilings or boats. And the interesting thing is that they've all evolved different strategies to find a good spot to stick. And so they respond to different chemical cues. They also create different types of glues. And then the way the glue hardens underwater is different for all these different invertebrates. So what I found intriguing most was that microorganisms are also looking for a hard surface to stick so that they can switch their lifestyle from a planktonic swimming stage to form a biofilm, which they do readily back and forth. So barnacles have to interact with the bacteria when they attempt to stick themselves, which is the most important thing that they'll do in their life.
So it sounds like the next house hunters is house hunters' microbiome. So then what have you found about how the bacteria and the barnacles work together sort of in this competition for prime real estate?
Yeah. So in terms of sticking, all the important stuff for the barnacle is going on underneath it, where it's connecting to this surface that's going to be its home. And so as I began my research with Dr. Dan Richoff at the Duke University Marine Lab, I thought about what happens underneath the barnacle in terms of the bacteria that were on that rock or ship or dock before the larvae settled. Do the bacteria become incorporated into the adhesive? Are they thriving under the animal, or are they killed off in some way? So what I found was that bacteria seem to be attracted to the glue that the barnacles first secrete when the larvae begin this settlement and metamorphosis. But during this transition to a juvenile, the animal puts out a second material closer to the edge of the base where it's trying to stick. And these bacteria that were under there and perhaps attracted to the glue are killed off during this process. And the interesting thing is that many processes that help liquids harden, like or coagulate, think about your blood clotting, these are also antimicrobial. And so what we saw was something that looked like a coagulated liquid at this interface of every barnacle at the end of metamorphosis. And we also found dead bacteria and evidence of one mechanism that could facilitate coagulation and killing bacteria.
So it sounds like the barnacles are winning out in this fight for real estate. Yes. Does your research have implications for helping ships or other structures that we don't want to be colonized by barnacles?
Yes. Many people think of barnacles as nuisances. We were funded largely by the Office of Naval Research for this work because they're very interested in having paints on their ships and coatings on sensors that prevent barnacles from sticking or enable the removal of biofouling in general. So in the past, coatings on paints and on ships have been found to be very toxic and nonspecific to biofouling organisms. So they're essentially polluting the waters around them. And ONR, the Office of Naval Research, funds research like this to facilitate the development of more environmentally friendly paints. So one of our main goals for that work was to inform scientists who are working on creating these coatings of potential points that they could intervene with adhesive processes.
That sounds like a great alternative to toxic paints. So you mentioned that you also studied two other crabs. Are other animals secreting these liquids that can alter the marine microbiome or biofilms?
Yeah, it seems that this is a common strategy. So two of the crabs that I worked on were blue crabs and fiddler crabs, and they both are secreting enzymes in fluid around them, which are able to degrade biofilms on various surfaces. So these were in two different contexts. So in blue crabs, they're trying to keep their eggs clean that they're carrying on their underside, which is very important for the development of the embryos inside them. And in fiddler crabs, they're actually secreting these on their legs, which is helping remove little biofilms off of grains of sand, which then they eat. So there's a lot of ways to remove biofilms, and this could be not just to clear off, you know, for a surface to stick, but also to help you feed or keep your offspring healthy.
Yeah, it seems to be a common theme throughout all of these talks that the marine microbiome is impacting life in a number of different ways. Mm-hmm. So moving forward, do you think you'll continue focusing on barnacles and crabs, or are you changing directions and looking at the way that other marine animals interact with the microbiome?
Yeah, my previous work introduced me to these principles of the interactions between marine macroorganisms and microorganisms, and really highlighted the importance of studying plants and animals in a broader ecological context. And this set me up for my postdoctoral work, which is rooted in studying animals and the role of microorganisms and their development. So I'm now working with Dr. Margaret McFall Nye in the Pacific Biosciences Research Center at UH's Kualoa Marine Lab. And we're working on this very close relationship between the Hawaiian bobtail squid and one specific marine bacterium, Vibrio fischeri. And this macroorganism and microorganism set has an intimate relationship, a beneficial symbiosis, where the bacteria provide light to the squid by producing a luminous protein, which allows the squid to glow on its underside and is acting as a form of camouflage for the squid while it hunts at night. So it can blend in with the moonlight because these bacteria are glowing underneath it. So it's kind of like countershading where an animal is darker on the top, like a shark, and lighter on the underside, but it's the reverse and it's happening at night. So in this symbiosis, the bacteria are housed in a very specific organ inside the squid on the underside. And that allows them access to nutrients and protects them from competing microorganisms and predators in the environment.
That's really fascinating. And it sounds a lot like the corals who are actually bringing the microbes into their own body. So is that common throughout the marine ecosystems to incorporate microbes into their bodies and use them symbiotically?
Yeah, we're learning more and more about examples of symbioses like this. And this is one example of a very close, intimate relationship, much like the coral and all of the microbiome that participates in keeping it healthy. But like the crabs, those are examples of more kind of broad interactions between macroorganisms and microorganisms. So there's a wide range in how closely knit different groups of organisms are. So we're just beginning to really unravel these things.
Fascinating. What are you trying to answer any questions in particular about how the squid and Vibrio are interacting in this research model?
Yes. Dr. McFall Nye and her collaborator, Dr. Ned Ruby, have been studying the squid Vibrio symbiosis for the past 25 years or so, and they've established it as not only a fascinating example of animal-microbe interactions in the marine environment, but also as a robust model for studying microbial impacts on animal and human health and development. With all of the work over the past decade on the human microbiome, we've learned that numerous microbes live with us and that different parts of the human body are actually very different habitats with distinct communities of microbes. If you recall, Dr. Gates was talking about the very different communities and different depths of coral. And so it's much like that on the human body, where your intestinal tract is a very different community than your skin. So what's most exciting to me is that we're now discovering how signals from microorganisms tell our cells how to respond in ways other than just telling immune cells to attack a pathogen. And because we live with so many microbes, our bodies need to be able to distinguish which microorganisms are beneficial to them and which are detrimental. So really, most interactions our cells have with microbes are neutral or positive, but most of the research has been done on the negative ones. Also, Ruth talked about. And because humans have so many different microbes in and on us, it can be challenging to figure out exactly which ones are doing what. And so we're using the squid model to study the chemical communication between one microorganism, the Vibrio fischeri, and one animal, the squid, and what the developmental impacts are on the squid because of this symbiosis. And interestingly, the organ that the bacteria interact with, the light organ, has parts of it that are similar to tissue in the lung and parts that are similar to the lining of your intestinal tract, which are two areas of important interactions with microbes, which can lead to disease. So the idea is if we understand the dynamics of a beneficial relationship, like the squid and this glowing bacterium, it may help us understand when things go wrong and lead to disease in an animal or human.
I often think of myself as a little bit different than a squid, but...
You're not.
Shucks. So when you say that the squid lungs are similar to humans, is it that they're similarly colonized by different microbes? They have a similar chemical and biological makeup? Or what parallels can we draw between us and squid?
Yeah. So I'm actually referring to the light organ itself. So on where the bacteria are housed in the squid. So on the outside of the light organ, you have ciliated epithelium that's much like your lung, which is ciliated on the lining. And then as the bacteria move into the light organ to reach these deep crypts where then they live for 24 hours, that tissue transitions into more of a microvilli-coated epithelium, which is much more like your intestinal tract. So within one organ in the squid, we have parallels to two organs in humans and vertebrates.
Interesting. But the bacteria aren't necessarily the same.
No. So this is the same bacterium is interacting with these very different tissue types and causing different changes in the gene expression of those tissues. And so we're trying to understand how, as different types of tissue associate with the same bacterium, what happens to the animal.
Interesting. Do you have plans to expand beyond the squid vibrio symbiosis to look at other potentially beneficial bacteria?
That would be the long-term research goal. Not quite advertising, looking for a job yet, like Oscar, but in the next few years, after completing this postdoc here, yeah, I'll be looking into expanding to other examples of symbioses.
Great. If listeners are interested in learning more about their microbiome or other marine animal microbiomes, what would you recommend as potential resources?
I have two books that I'd highly recommend. One is by Ed Yong, and it's called I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us and a Grander View of Life. He's a wonderful writer. I got the chance to meet him at a beneficial microbe meeting recently. And he talks about some fascinating examples of animal microbe symbioses in the book. The other is a more human health-related one, and it's by Dr. Martin Blaser, who's the director of the Human Microbiome Project at NYU. And it's called Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. In the book, he does a wonderful job of discussing the findings of human microbiome research in an accessible way and demonstrates why we need to care about understanding the microbiome and its impact on our health. They're really great reads.
Perfect. One last question. So it seems like throughout humans and corals, there's a lot of sharing of microbiomes. I guess the more the merrier. With the squid that you're studying, do you see that there's an advantage to sharing or not sharing these Vibrio or encouraging a whole population to have them?
Yeah, the interesting thing is that the squid doesn't need the Vibrio fishery to live. So squid that don't have them just aren't glowing, but they gain an advantage to glow for this camouflage when they do have them. And some of the work in our lab is looking at different strains of this Vibrio fishery and seeing different competitive advantages of these strains one over the other into accessing the part of the light organ they need to and how much light they provide. So, there's a lot to learn.
Yeah, this is definitely a very complicated topic, but I'm very grateful that all three of you are working hard to help elucidate some of the complexities that exist within the ocean. Does anyone have any last-minute comments or recommendations for how viewers or listeners could help protect the microbiome or get involved in research or understanding it?
Go on easy on the planet. Try to do healthy things for the planet, including your personal habits.
Perfect.
Yeah, and along with the one book recommendation talking about antibiotics, to be really conscious of overuse of antibiotics and understanding that we don't want to just kill off all microbes within us or to treat disease, and that, you know, it's about balance and promoting health in general.
And I'll say that if there's any kids listening to this and you need something and a job in the future, study microbes. Microbiology rocks.
Yes, it does. And I think we all also need to remember to take care of our own microbiomes. We've seen in this hour that they're not only harmful, but also very helpful and maybe give us a little competitive advantage, even if we're not trying to glow in the sea. Well, thank you again for joining us. As a reminder, our three guests today were Drs. Oscar Sosa, Ruth Gates, and Tara Essick Burns. Today was just a tiny introduction into the fascinating world of the marine microbiome. You can always learn more about the marine microbiome on the All Things Marine website. I'm Holly Lauritsen. Thanks for tuning in. And now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet and its marine microbiome. Thanks again.